Welcome to episode 43 of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. We had a brief, what do we have, 2 weeks off, Chad?
Yeah, pretty close to that, I think.
I fell asleep and didn't wake up. I went into hibernation for 2 weeks, but we are back. And Chad, where are we at in the 40 minutes, in the narrative of Genesis?
We are actually at a kind of a climactic moment here. We're in Genesis 32, and Jacob is just about to have his encounter with his estranged brother, but he's going to have an encounter with somebody else before we get there.
All right, let's do it.
All right, very good. So when we left off last time, we wrapped up the end of chapter 31. And if you remember, that was when Jacob bids farewell to his exile and has that run-in with Laban, his father-in-law, and they kind of get everything settled. They make a treaty and both swear that they're not going to cross over this memorial stone back to harm the other. So it ends on a fairly positive note with Jacob and his father-in-law. And we pick up with chapter 32 with Jacob's hesitation, fear, with regard to his reunion with his brother. If you remember, it's been 2 decades since Jacob stole the birthright from his brother, and his brother wanted to kill him. And so the last communication that Jacob had with Esau was murderous in tone. His brother wanted to take his life, so Jacob takes off. And over the last 20 years, as Jacob has thought of his brother, no doubt all he thought was that his brother's still angry and his brother can't wait to get his pound of flesh. At least judging from Jacob's reactions in this chapter, that's what he still thinks. So this has been eating at him for the last 20 years, but he's going home. God told him to go home. He was ready to go home. And so they are heading that way. But before he gets there, we're going to have a few things happen. And at the end of the chapter, the end of chapter 32 is where we have a very, very interesting episode of Jacob wrestling with a man who's an angel, who's also God. So we'll get there in just a few minutes. Now, this chapter starts out with kind of a strange occurrence. So the last chapter ends with these words. It says, "Then Laban departed and returned to his place." And chapter 32 begins, "Now, as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, 'This is God's camp.' So he named that place Mahanaim," which in Hebrew means two camps. And that's all that's said about it. Some angels meet him. This isn't the first time that Jacob's had an encounter with angels. And he names the place Mahanaim, which becomes an important city later in Israel's history. Now, what's interesting about this is, first of all, Jacob has these angels. He's been under divine protection ever since he left the promised land 20 years earlier. The angels are still there with him, still watching over him, protecting him, just like they do us. So Jacob sees them, and he names the place where he has this vision of the angels, Mahanaim, which means two camps. Now, this is going to become significant in just a minute, so kind of bear that in mind, this idea of there being two camps of angels in a place called Mahanaim. So kind of set that aside for a moment. We'll come back to it in a minute. But at this point, we got to figure out how Jacob is going to deal with Esau, or Jacob has to figure out for himself what's going to happen. So he's kind of a twofold strategy here. His first plan begins verse 3. He sends messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he sends these messengers ahead with a very specific message. He tells them that they are to say to not his brother Esau, but to his lord Esau, which is interesting. He calls Esau his lord. "So thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob." This is a direct quote. This is what the servants are to tell Esau. "I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now, and I have oxen and donkeys and flocks, and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my Lord that I may find favor in your sight. So I guess what's going on here is that Jacob is not bragging. He's not sending his messengers ahead to tell Esau, hey, bro, I just want you to know that I'm rich now, and I've done really well for myself. Instead, he's sending these messengers ahead to tell Esau, my Lord Esau, I know that you're probably angry with me still, but I have enough possessions to be able to pay you back for what I've stolen from you. That seems to be what's going on here. He's got these male and female servants, flocks, herds, and all of this. And so he's going to be able to pay his brother back for the crime of stealing his birthright. So that's the plan. He sends messengers ahead. They have this very specific message to deliver to his Lord, Esau. And here's what happens. The messengers get back and they say, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Now, what's interesting about this is that the messengers don't communicate anything about what Esau said, if he said anything. Presumably, the messengers tell Esau this, but they don't come back to Jacob with any message from Esau. In fact, all they come back with is a description of how Esau is coming out to meet Jacob. And these 400 men with him do not bode well for Jacob. There's a few other places, in particular in 1 Samuel, where 400 men are associated with David. It seems to be sort of the biblical number for a militia. So you got these 400 soldiers who are with Esau. And when Jacob hears this, all that he can think about is that Esau is coming back for revenge. He's going to attack him. He's going to get his revenge that he's been waiting for two decades to get. So that's kind of the first plan that Jacob has, and it doesn't go so well. At least that's Jacob's interpretation of it. He's going to try and buy his brother's favor with this message of how much he has. And all that he hears in response is that Esau is bringing a militia out to meet him. Now, we know Jacob. Jacob is a man of plotting and conniving. And so he comes up with plan number two. And it's kind of got two components to it. The first is a prayer that Jacob prays. We'll get to that first. And then the second part of it is he divides up his possessions in order that he might send them ahead of him in order to placate the anger of Esau by giving him these gifts. But before we get to those, we have a very interesting verse here, because after the men come back, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. So he divides the people who are with him and his flocks and his herds and his camels into two different companies. And he says to himself, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. Now, you got to step back from this story for a minute and ask yourself, wouldn't there be another way that Jacob could go about this? How about, now this is just throwing out an idea there, how about that Jacob himself goes to meet his brother Esau? How about he goes out, instead of sending messengers, instead of dividing up his family and all his possessions, instead of, as we'll see as the story goes on, sending, you know, herd after flock to try and win favor from his brother. How about Jacob simply goes out to meet his brother Esau? I mean, is that not a feasible option?
No, that's not what people do. People do not go and say, I'm going to go and talk to the person with whom I have a problem. It's not what happens. It's not what happens in real life. It's not what happens. It becomes this elaborate game of playing chess.
Yeah, and making assumptions, right? Isn't that what Jacob is doing? He's making assumptions about Esau.
Yeah, he's like, this guy is come. He's gonna bust me up because I deserve it. And so, yeah, I'm going to divide my stuff, and I'm going to figure out how to appease him.
Yeah, that's exactly what Jacob does. He doesn't take the honest approach. He doesn't take the courageous approach. He doesn't take the humble and self-sacrificial approach. Instead, he comes up with every... He eventually will, interestingly, when we get to chapter 23. But at this point, Jacob is being Jacob. Jacob is totally being the deceiver, supplanter, the Jacob who's always concerned about Jacob. So he tries everything he can to avoid actually doing what he's supposed to do. And it's easier, I think, in some ways, it's easier for Jacob to believe the worst of Esau. Because it confirms his suspicions. That is the way that people are. They always want to believe. Luther says in the Large Catechism that people always prefer to believe the worst about other people. They always rejoice more in the evil than they do in the good.
Well, yeah. What this is too, I think, what people do, what Jacob's doing too, is you project your own dirtbagness onto somebody else. And so you're like, this is how I would respond to this person. So therefore, that's how surely they are going to respond as well. So Jacob probably knows, like, man, if I was Esau, I would be looking to kill me. I'd be looking to just go ballistic on me. There's no way I'm talking to that dude, because if it's true of me, it's true of him. And that's we all do that.
Yeah, we all do. Yeah. Yeah, very often our unworthy accusations against someone else are nothing more than an inward reflection of what's going on in our own heart. We're troubled by our own sin, we're troubled by our greed or our lust or whatever it is, and so we tend to think that that's exactly what's going on with someone else. So we read our own sin into someone else. So Jacob thinks his brother Esau is just like him. Whereas we have seen throughout this story that if anybody comes out looking like he's a pretty good guy, it's Esau. It's not Jacob. Jacob repeatedly is a conniver, is a plotter, is a thief. And Esau just seemed like a pretty good guy who got the short end of the stick. And it's not going to change, because we'll see in just a minute, Esau ends up being the good guy in the story once more. So we have to spend a moment with this prayer that Jacob prays, because I find it even more illuminating about Jacob. Because I won't read the whole prayer, but basically Jacob addresses God, God of my father, Abraham and Isaac. And he quotes God. He says, you know, you told me to go back to my country and my relatives, and I'm unworthy of all the love and the faithfulness that you've shown me, and I want you to deliver me from the hand of my brother, because I'm afraid he's going to come and attack me and the mothers of my children. Now, on the surface, this prayer can kind of come across as a pretty good prayer. I mean, there's some aspects to it which are good, but
sanctimonious, man.
If you look at it more closely, it's a very is Jacobian. Is that a word?
Jacobian.
It's a very Jacobian prayer. It's very much a prayer that reflects who Jacob is, because when he quotes God, I mean, and he's quoting God, he actually changes the words, because God told him to return to his country and to his relatives, and God promised and I will be with you. But when Jacob quotes God, he says, God, you told me to return to my country, my relatives, and you would prosper me. You would, literally the Hebrew, it's the, if there's any anybody out there listening who's who knows Hebrew, it's a hifil verb, which is a verb which means like to cause to happen. So literally it's to cause good to come upon me. And so when Jacob, twice in this prayer, twice he quotes God, but he inserts something into it which is not there. God promised I will be with you, and Jacob says, like you said, God, you promised that you would prosper me. And then there's this other line, and this is what I find, I guess, most humorous about this prayer, because he says, when I crossed the Jordan, God, all I had was my staff, and now I have become two companies. The reason you became two companies is because you just split everybody up. So he's like talking to God, boasting about every much, however many blessings he has, and he's really nothing doing more than he's reflecting his own plan of self-protection. Yeah, I have so much. I have two companies. Well, of course you do. You just split everybody up because you said if they strike one, the other one will be safe. So I don't know about this prayer. It comes across as nothing more than Jacob is trying to control God. He's trying to control the whole situation, and now he's trying to control God by this sort of prayerful manipulation of God. Which is, you know, it's not uncommon. How many times, oh my gosh, I would be a rich man if I had a dollar for every time that I've prayed a prayer which is self-serving and attempts to manipulate God into doing what I want him to do. You know, try and make deals with God, or pray things which are nothing more than a reflection of my own self-interest. So just because a prayer is in the Bible doesn't mean it's a good prayer. It doesn't mean it's a pious prayer. People talk to God in self-serving ways all the time.
Yeah, sometimes our prayers are that way, not even because of what we're asking for, but we're just like trying to find like the right words. I mean, like, have you ever been in like you ever been praying, like maybe like a group of guys is praying and it becomes like a prayer competition?
Oh yeah, big time,
fantastic. And so then it just becomes like who can sound the most heavenly. Use the most awe-inspiring words. This is what Jesus accuses the Pharisees of, right? Like lengthy prayers, like flowery speech.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, prayers, competitive prayers, boastful prayers. I can remember praying one time, making a bargain with God. I would do this if he would do that. And I was so angry when he didn't follow through with it. I set up the whole situation, you know. I was in this relationship that I was afraid it was going to end, and so I came up with this deal. You know, I told God that I would quit doing this and that if he would save this relationship. So I set the whole thing up. And I obligate God to do something based upon my own actions. And then when he doesn't follow through with what I obligated him to do, I'm pissed. When I came up for the whole situation to begin with. It's pretty pitiful.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a Jacob.
Yeah, I was Jacob at that moment.
I got two companies. Here's the deal. Here's the plan, God. Here's the plan.
Yeah, let me tell you how this is going to go down. So Jacob, he prays his prayer. And of course, God doesn't respond. There's no need to. But then he moves to, that's the first part. He's going to kind of control God, and he's going to control his brother. So what he does is he takes all these goats and sheep and camels and cows and donkeys and all these animals, 550 in all. and he splits them up into several different flocks and herds. And he appoints a servant to each one of these flocks and herds, and he puts a little distance between each of them, and he sends them on ahead, and each shepherd or each servant is told to say this. He says, like, you know, when you come to Esau, you're supposed to, and Esau says, you know, who are you? Where are you going? Just kind of questions him. They are to say, these belong to your servant Jacob, and it is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us. So what he's trying to do, and he admits this, he's trying to appease him with all of these presents, which I find very very interesting, because this is exactly the approach that his unloved wife has taken toward him, and it never worked. You know, poor Leah was always trying to win the affections of her husband Jacob by doing this or doing that, bearing all these sons, doing all these things for him, and it never worked. But Jacob thinks that he can now win the affections of his brother by the same mechanism. So that's his plan. He's going to, he prayed, and so he's got everything set up for what God's supposed to do. And now he's divided up his possessions, and he's going to pacify his brother by giving all these gifts to him. Now, to kind of jump ahead over the next story, when Jacob does finally meet Esau, I love Esau's response. Esau's more or less like, "What's all this stuff? You know, why'd you send all these animals ahead of me? I don't need all this stuff. I'm rich. I mean, I've got plenty of stuff already. Why'd you do this?" And Jacob has to press Esau to accept these gifts. Esau's like, "I don't need all this stuff. What's up with all these flocks and herds?" So the whole thing was unnecessary. But that's Jacob for you. Okay, now getting back to chapter 32 and to the way this chapter wraps up, it is the story of Jacob wrestling with the mysterious visitor. So this starts in beginning in 22. What happens is Jacob ends up all by himself. He's at this place called the Jabbok River, which flows into the Jordan River, and he takes his whole family across. So he sent all his possessions ahead, all these gifts for his brother Esau, and during the night, he takes his wives and his co-wives and his 11 children, and he takes them all across the river. And then, for some reason, Jacob goes back across, and he's there all by himself. So it's sort of the end is like the beginning, because Jacob leaves his homeland all by himself. And now here he is on the verge of going back into his home country. And once more, he's alone. And not only that, but when Jacob left, he had that vision of God, the ladder extending to heaven during the night. And once more, this is a night encounter that Jacob has with God. So it's sort of, everything's come full circle. He was in Bethel at night. God appears to him. Now he's just about to go back into the homeland. He's alone, and he's under cover of darkness. And it says that it begins with kind of a mysterious description. It simply says a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And that's all it tells us. So presumably, when this starts, some guy jumps Jacob, and they start fighting together. And Jacob has, at first anyway, has no idea who he is. He's just a man who is Jacob's match in strength and ability, because neither one of them are able to gain the upper hand. And we'll kind of cover the story, then we'll go back and talk about it. So When the man saw that he couldn't prevail against Jacob, he touches the socket of Jacob's thigh, and it's dislocated. So he weakens Jacob. And then he says, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." And it's at this point that we realize that Jacob has come to know that it's not just a man he's wrestling with. It's someone who is much more than a man, because he says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And the man asks him, "What is your name?" He says, "Jacob." And he says, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And then the man refuses to tell Jacob his own name. But then Jacob, to kind of wrap this up, Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." So that's kind of the basic story, which probably most of you who are listening already know. But let's go back and talk about this, because depending on when this comes out, right now we're recording on a couple days before Good Friday, and this is actually a perfect, in my opinion, a perfect time to go over this particular story in Jacob's life, because as I'll explain in just a second, this really is a Good Friday kind of story. It's one of those Old Testament stories which theologically gives us an insight into what happens on Good Friday, what happens in the crucifixion of our Lord. It's one of many of these shadows or images that we have in the Old Testament of what is going to take place when God becomes man and God as man dies in our stead. But I'll get there in a minute. So we start out here with, first of all, one of the many times in the Old Testament when God takes on human form. He's called a man. Later on in Hosea 12, when he talks about this, he's called an angel. But he's all three. This is God taking on temporarily a human form so that he can, in this case, wrestle with Jacob. You know, this is the most, I guess I might say, the most earthy encounter that any Old Testament figure has with God appearing in human form. And they actually fight.
Yeah.
You know, this is not like earlier, I think that's Genesis 18, where the Lord and two angels appear to Abraham and they sit down and have a meal together, and the Lord and his angels are eating and drinking. Yeah, that's earthy, but this is actually a fight that takes place.
It's also the reason I believe that God is a vampire.
Because he prefers nighttime.
He's like,
you gotta leave before the dawn breaks, right?
The sun's coming up, bro. I gotta go.
I gotta go. The light's gonna be here just a minute. I gotta split.
Yes.
That's, you know, it's a...
That's for all those teen fiction novel readers out there.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. God is vampire.
Little nugget.
You know, it is it's quite fascinating to me that God not only appears as a man, but, and this isn't like an apparition. This is a temporary assumption of flesh and blood. I mean, this is a man, God as a man, who is able to stand toe to toe with Jacob and to get down in the dirt and wrestle, which is actually what the Hebrew word for wrestle there is related to the word for dust. So it's this idea, you know, they're fighting on the ground and there's clouds of dust coming up because they're stirring it up as they're fighting with each other. And it's not my son's a wrestler and his rounds are either 1 or 2 minutes. This isn't a 1 or 2 minute round. This is an all night kind of a wrestling match that takes place.
I think it's really interesting that, you know, they're wrestling all night. And it says that, you know, that I mean, basically that Jacob like beats him, right?
He can't get the better of Jacob.
But which is like obviously not true, because he's like, oh, I can't get the better of this guy. I guess I'll just touch him on the hip and dislocate his. I mean, like, so it's like, so like, I mean, so it's like, oh man, I really can't beat this guy. Like, wah, and then
So
like
instead,
all of a
I'll
sudden your
choose
hip.
my supernatural powers to dislocate his hip.
I mean, like, so dude could have like stopped his heart right in a second or something. Like, so I like that there's this when Jesus says that, like no one takes my life from me, I give it up, this kind of thing. And like you don't beat God in a wrestling match unless God
Wants to
makes
be.
you like so what God does here is he doesn't just take on flesh and blood, but he also listen, this people get freaked out when you say things like this, but like but God makes himself your equal. It condescends to the point that you could beat him, and will condescend to the point that you could kill him. Only because he's willing to have it be so, because he could just touch your hip or call down legions of angels or whatever. But he is a God that, like, on the regular, makes himself low, bring like makes himself your equal, makes it to where. Literally makes it to where you could strive with God and prevail, as he says, which is a crazy God.
It is a crazy God. That's one of the reasons why I think this particular story gives us a deeper insight into the incarnation than perhaps any other Old Testament story. Because the incarnation is exactly what you're describing. God makes himself our equal. He passed through every stage of life that we do. He's conceived, he's born, he is a baby, he's a toddler, he's an adult, he hungers, he thirsts, he bleeds, he dies. So everything that we experience as humans, he himself experiences. And as he does that, he opens himself up to the same hostilities from sinners to which we ourselves are subject. So he opens himself up to being cursed, to being lied about, to being betrayed, to being arrested, and eventually to being executed for the sins of humanity. So what this story does is it's a window into the willingness of God to subject himself fully to human limitations and to subject himself fully to death itself, to being actually defeated by his own children, in order that in his defeat, they themselves might gain the victory.
That he would let he'd allow himself to be beaten. It's odd. Jacob has his wits about him enough to know that a blessing would be a good idea, because in the defeat of God comes a blessing, and literally the blessing to those who defeated him, those who killed him, which would be me and you.
This is sort of a God is the biggest loser kind of story. And this is the way that God works. So God allows himself to be bested, to be beaten, to be conquered by Jacob here on purpose, in order that in God's loss, Jacob might receive gain. In God's death, we might receive life. I mean, if there's any story which tells us that there is no limit to what God will do in order to bring us back, this is it. So God, I mean, I don't know if I can, I can't come up with the words to communicate it well enough,
Well,
that
you
the
haven't.
creator of heaven and earth will lose in order that we might gain.
Yeah, you have a God who is will go to the point of taking on flesh and rolling around in the dirt all night, getting scraped up, cut up. You got a God that's willing to just to have an all night wrestling match on the ground that he made to bring this dude back.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a dude that seeks and saves the lost like no other.
Like no other. Yeah, I mean, he's. And this is part of the story that we see throughout the rest of the Old Testament. But it really comes to its climax on Good Friday. That's why I brought that up earlier, because here we have on Good Friday the God who is willing to wrestle with humanity, to be arrested by humanity, to be mocked and beaten and whipped and crucified. To be last, to be the one who is betrayed, the one who is abandoned, the one who dies all alone, to suffer this tremendous loss. But it's all part of the plan that we might gain the victory, that our name might be changed to saint instead of sinner, to saved instead of lost, to alive instead of dead, to believer instead of unbeliever, to the children of God. So this is the way our names too are changed when God loses and we win. So the name Israel means the one who has fought with God and with men and has prevailed. I mean, the name itself is astounding, because the name Israel tells us the limitless grace of God, that he is willing to be beaten in order that we might gain the victory through his loss. It's astounding.
And we do become Israel. We all get brought in.
We all get brought in. We are the, as Paul says, we are the Israel of God, collectively as the church and individually as believers. it's not a vain boast. But it's a divine gift. God gives the name. He doesn't say to Jacob, "Hey, you know, let's change your name. What do you want to be called now?" He gives the name change. So the one who is beaten in order that Jacob might prevail gives him the name of prevailing. You have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And Jacob realizes he's seen God face to face in this encounter, and there's more truth to his words, I think, than he realizes, because not only has he seen God face to face in a physical sense, he's been toe to toe with him, but he's actually seen, he's had revealed to him what the face of God is really like, what God's character is really like, how he presents himself to the world, the face that he gives to the world. And it's a face that's willing to go to these lengths in order to give a name change to Jacob, in order to save us, in order to give us eternal life. So this is a face-to-face encounter with who God really is, and that God is a God of grace and mercy, and the God who gives us victory by being defeated by the very people that he came to save. So this story has the crucifixion and the incarnation written all over it, and it's a story that really is about the strange ways of a God who loses in order that his children might win.
That's it. And that's where we're going to have to leave it, Chad. We're going to have to leave it right there. It's a good spot to leave it. Go over to ChristHoldFast.org. And if you enjoy this program or any of the other stuff that we do and would like to support it, that would go a long way. You can go over to the site and go to support, and you can sign up to contribute. And thank you so much for those of you who have done that. We will see you guys next week.